Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm John Keimel. Today we take you to Colby College for a talk by former Senate Majority Leader and now Special Presidential Envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell. The title of his talk is Conflict Resolution, Reflections on Personal Experiences. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Sandy Mazel, director of the Goldfarb Center at Colby College.
Good evening, and welcome to the fourth George J. Mitchell Distinguished International Lecture, sponsored by the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. It is a wonderful pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight. As many of you know, 5 years ago, George's brother Paul and his nephew Bill and his cousins, the Nails and the Baldacci's, and many members of the Mitchell family and the Nail family and the Baldacci family came together to say, wouldn't it be wonderful to have an event at Colby every year in which we brought to the campus a distinguished lecturer to talk about international issues, in which we could raise the visibility of Colby and raise the visibility of Waterville and bring this wonderful community and this wonderful college together. So would you please all join me in thanking the Mitchell family for making this possible. And what a wonderful series it has been. As many of you know, we've had the last two lecturers who have been in this chapel were the former president of Ireland and the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson. One of my students said to a Colby audience last night that that event was the highlight of his Colby career. You can't beat that. And then 2 years ago when former Secretary of State Albright was here, and none of us will ever forget the two-hour-long line of people waiting to sign her book, and she never left for that entire time and gave a terrific speech. Well, we will have another one tonight. There are times when you say the speaker needs no introduction. George Mitchell needs no introduction to a Waterville audience. He may need a slight introduction to some of our freshmen and sophomores, but only to our freshmen and sophomores. For the rest, he is a household name. He is a distinguished son of Waterville. He did go to college elsewhere in the state of Maine. But as many of us have heard, and I just want to say it before he does, he worked here on the grounds at Colby after he got his Bowdoin degree, before he got his first job, which says, according to his father, that the necessity to work on the grounds crew at Colby was holding a Bowdoin degree, and nothing has changed. Senator Mitchell's career has indeed been a distinguished one. From the time that he graduated from Georgetown Law School, and worked as an assistant district, a U.S. attorney, and then to work as a special assistant to Senator Mitchell, and then moving back to the state of Maine, and his first run for office, which in one way we all want to forget because of the result, but another way we all want to remember because we were so proud to be part of it, his unsuccessful campaign for governor in 1974, and then his service, again, for the Democratic Party often, as a federal district judge in U.S. District Judge, headquartered in Portland, and then from 1980 to 1995 as a distinguished United States Senator, and for the last six of those years as the Majority Leader of the United States Senate. I don't like to talk about my research in giving an introduction, but I've been involved in this really fascinating project in which I have been trying to measure the effectiveness of United States senators by getting those people who know about such things, an unbiased sample of people to rate all of the United States senators who have served in the last 50 years. And when I did that, the number one senator of the last 50 years in terms of effectiveness was George J. Mitchell from the state of Maine. Tonight, Senator Mitchell is here to talk to us about conflict resolution, and he has had a distinguished second career resolving conflicts around the world. He spent 5 years, as most of you know, as a special envoy to Northern Ireland, and his efforts, frustrating for much of that time, resulted in the Good Friday Accords and bringing a much-needed peace to that very troubled region. Near the end of the, and for that effort, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Clinton. Near the end of the Clinton administration, he did his first tour of duty trying to resolve and figure out a solution to the conflicts of the Middle East. And then just 2 days after he took office, President Obama named Senator Mitchell as special envoy to the Middle East, demonstrating both how important solving that region's problems are to the president and the respect with which he holds Senator Mitchell. It is indeed a high honor and a deep personal privilege to introduce Senator George J. Mitchell, never special envoy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sandy, thank you very much for that generous introduction. Thank all of you, ladies and gentlemen, for your presence and for your warm reception. I take every opportunity I can get to return to Waterville, both to see the members of my family, to see old friends, many of whom are here this evening, and wherever I go and whatever I do, I still and always will regard Waterville as my home. I feel a special attachment to Kobe. Not many of you here are old enough to recall, well, Sam is, and Al Joseph and others, the old Kobe campus. We grew up just a few hundred yards away from the old Kobe campus, and I can still recall going up to the old Severance Field and jumping over the fence to get in to watch the football games and the baseball games there. Later, as almost all of you know, perhaps the freshmen don't, my father was a janitor here at Kobe, and he left school after the fourth grade, but when he talked about Kobe, you would have thought he was a member of the founding family, because he was really fond of it, spoke of it often, and for both my father and mother and all of my family, Kobe has been a very important part of our lives. As Sandy mentioned, I did work here the summer after graduating from Bowdoin. It was the only job I could get at the time, working on the grounds crew at Kobe. But I'd also spent the previous summer working here on construction. Are there any students here who have lived in Foss Hall during your time at Kobe? Well, I want you to know that I spent one entire summer building that beautiful terrace lawn out in front of Foss Hall. And I want you the next... the next time any of you are pass by it or sit out there and enjoy a sunny spring or fall day, I want you to think about me. It took 3 months of very hard labor to get that beautiful terrace in shape. This also is a place, of course, where my brother Johnny has spent many years. Sandy was nice enough to describe this as a significant event, but this evening pales into insignificance compared to the event held at the Sea Club recently where they honored my brother Johnny, the really famous member of my family. Where is the Swisher? Would you please stand, Swisher, and be recognized? Harriet Lynn. I wondered what he's doing way up and back, but then I noticed the cameras are out that way, so. I had also a reminder of both Waterville and Kobe just recently. I've been to the Middle East and to North Africa almost every month this year in my present assignment. And on one visit, I stopped in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. In Tunisia, I was asked by the U.S. ambassador there to participate in a ceremony at the U.S. military cemetery located just outside of Tunis, the capital city, on a beautiful bluff overlooking the Mediterranean. There are buried about 6,000 Americans who lost their lives during the North Africa and campaign in Sicily in 1942 and 1943. Those whose remains were recovered are buried in one of these just moving settings where row after row of white markers designate the final resting place of about 3,000 individuals. About an equal number were missing in action. And so all along a low granite wall, looking out over the Mediterranean, are inscribed the names of the 3,000, their unit, and the state from which they came. In the very first granite tablet, I noticed there were two young men from Maine, and as I was escorted by an honor guard along this low wall, I was struck by the clearly disproportionate number of young men and some women from Maine who had died in those campaigns, reflecting the fact that Maine has always been a very active participant in the defense of freedom and liberty around the world. And then I was taken aback when I got about halfway down the wall and I saw the name of Captain Robert Lafleur. The airport in Waterville is named after Robert Lafleur. He was a Waterville native, a great student, and a great athlete who came to Kobe, where he was the star of the Kobe football team. And I can remember, literally, almost as though it were yesterday, climbing the fence at Severance Field with a group of young friends from Waterville and going to see a football game that Kobe played because Bobby Lafleur was our hero. After 2 years at Kobe, he left to enter military service, became a captain in the Air Force, and served in numerous operations over Europe, and then finally his plane was lost at sea in the Mediterranean. And it brought back a rush of memories, not just about this great institution, not just about Waterville, but about the benefits and responsibilities of citizenship in this great country. Our society is imperfect, as are all human societies, all human efforts, and all human beings. But this is and remains the most open, the most just, and the most free society in all of human history. Characterized most of all by a willingness to examine critically our past and present policies and work hard to correct those that are wrong. I'm asked often about why I went to Northern Ireland and why I'm now in the Middle East. And my answer really is very simple. I feel very fortunate to have been a citizen of this country and of this state and this town. I feel I've been blessed with more than my share of good luck and good fortune, and if I in any way can be of some help to others and to pay back the debt I feel I owe this society, and especially my parents, why then, of course, I want to do it. And so when the president asked me about serving in this mission, I didn't hesitate. I got a lot of advice, just about everything you can imagine, but not one person said to me, it'll be really easy. And boy, were they right when they didn't say that. It is very difficult and complex, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment, and about my experiences in Northern Ireland, but I want to begin with some more general comments. Human history is in large part a story of conflict and of their resolution. It's not a new subject, but I believe it's taken on a new urgency in a world in which the number of people is increasing rapidly, the number of nation states continues to grow, the number of non-state organizations which initiate or extend conflicts is also on the rise, and rapid technological developments make it easier to start and continue conflicts than to prevent and end them. We live in an age of amazing technological development, and some of the most dramatic advances have come in the capacity of human beings to kill other human beings. I was in Baltimore just a few days ago, and I saw there an electric clock which projects the world's population through this century. It said that in 2080, there will be 11.5 billion people on Earth. I personally believe that's an overestimation, but it should be a cause for concern in any event, especially when compared to population growth in the past. Recall that it took 18 centuries, 1,800 years, for the Earth's population to reach 1 billion. The last billion was added in less than 20 years. Although the rate of growth is now slowing in some parts of the world, a credible estimate is that by 2050, there will be between 8.5 and 9 billion people on Earth. That means more competition for land, for water, for resources, more competition for economic growth, more competition for political power, and inevitably, more conflicts. 222 years ago, there was another conflict. And in 1787, 45 American colonists gathered in Philadelphia in the convention that produced the American Constitution. That part of the Constitution, which we call the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, is to me the most eloquent statement ever written by human beings of the right of the individual to be free of oppression by government. That's one side of the coin of liberty. The other side is the need for everyone to have a fair chance to enjoy the blessings of liberty. A man without a job, a woman who can't care for or feed her children, a young man or woman who lacks the skills needed to compete in this age of technology, they don't think much about liberty. They worry about coping day to day. The same is true of people living in societies torn by violence. Without civil order, without personal physical security, freedom comes to be seen as a mere concept, unrelated to the daily task of survival, of simply staying alive. So it was for many years in Northern Ireland and in the Middle East. Conflict hurts the economy. Unemployment rises with violence in a deadly cycle of escalating misery. Late in the 20th century, after 50 years of disagreement and discord, the British and Irish governments concluded if there was to be any hope of bringing the conflict there to an end, they would have to cooperate in a sustained effort to lay the foundation for peace. After years of trying, they finally were able to get peace negotiations underway in 1996. The two governments asked me to serve as chairman of those negotiations. I'd been involved in Northern Ireland long enough to understand what a difficult task that would be. Those negotiations, I chaired three of them over a five-year period, were the longest, most difficult I've ever been involved with, at least up until now. Often, no progress seemed possible, but somehow we kept going. There was an especially bleak and dangerous time in the Christmas season of 1997 and the early months of the following year. After a year and a half of talks that produced no results, I tried to get the competing parties to agree on a statement which identified the issues to be resolved. Not the answers, just the questions. I couldn't get them to do it. So when we adjourned for the Christmas season, it was a bleak outlook. I thought if they couldn't even agree on what the questions were, how could they ever possibly agree on the answers? 2 days later, a prominent Protestant paramilitary leader was murdered in prison by a group of Catholic prisoners. That touched off a surge of murders, bombings, and assassinations as a vicious cycle of revenge took hold. The process in which I'd been engaged for such a long time was moving backward. In desperation, I devised a plan to establish an early deadline for an end of the talks. I was convinced that the absence of a deadline guaranteed failure. I knew that the existence of a deadline didn't guarantee success, but I thought it at least made it possible. It took me a month to put the plan together to get them all to agree. I recommended a final and unbreakable deadline, and in trying to dramatize it a little bit, I bought an airplane ticket. And I called them all together, and I passed the ticket around so they could all see it. And I said, I'm going to be on that plane, and if we don't reach an agreement, you guys can go out and explain to the waiting world, there were about 500 camera crews and others there, why you couldn't get an agreement. Well, they recognized that the time had come to force a decision. And in those last few weeks, there were nonstop, round-the-clock negotiations, and finally, an agreement was reached. It's important to recognize that the agreement by itself didn't guarantee success. It made success possible, but it took another decade of hard work and hard decisions to achieve that result. I've since often been asked, over and over again, what lessons Northern Ireland holds for other conflicts, and of course, particularly now, the Middle East. And I'll try to answer that question, but I begin with caution. Each human being is unique. It follows logically that no two conflicts are the same, just as no two individuals are the same. And much as we would like it, there's no magic formula which, once discovered, can be used to end every conflict. But there are certain principles that arise out of my experience that I think are universal or nearly so. First, I believe deeply that there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. They're created and conducted by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. No matter how old the conflict, no matter how hateful or hurtful, peace can prevail. When I arrived in Northern Ireland, I found to my dismay a widespread feeling among the public and politicians that there was no prospect for peace. A hugely negative attitude had set in. It's a small, well-informed society. I quickly became well-known, and I was constantly stopped in the airport, on the street, going in and out of the hotel by people who offered kind and encouraging words, "Thank you, Senator, God bless you, keep it up," but they always ended by saying, "You're wasting your time." I will never forget a woman who looked like everybody's favorite grandmother coming up and saying to me, "We've been killing each other for centuries, and we're going to go on killing each other for centuries, no matter what you do." Well, as best I could, I worked to reverse these attitudes because I believe it's the special responsibility of political leaders from whom many in the public take their cue. And one way to do that is to create an attitude of hope and a prospect of success, the belief that problems can be solved, that things can be better, not in a foolish or unrealistic way, but in a way that creates hope, establishes confidence. A second need is for a clear and determined policy not to yield to those who believe that the answer to every problem is violence. Over and over, those in Northern Ireland who opposed the peace process tried to destroy it through the use of violence, through murder, through assassination, through bombing, through the physical maiming in the most horrible and disfiguring ways of thousands of their fellow citizens. At times, they nearly succeeded. And that means that in all of these circumstances, there has to be an endless supply of perseverance, determination, and patience. No matter how bleak the outlook, the search for peace is too important not to continue. Seeking an end to conflict is not for the timid or for the tentative. It takes courage, it takes perseverance, and it takes steady nerves in the face of horrific violence. I believe it a mistake for anyone to say in advance that if acts of violence occur, the peace process or negotiations will stop. That's an invitation to those who use violence to control the agenda. It transfers control from the peaceful majority to the violent minority. A third need is a willingness to compromise. Peace and political stability cannot be achieved in sharply divided societies unless there is genuine willingness to understand the other side's point of view and to enter into principled compromise. That's very easy to say, but extremely hard to do, because it requires of political leaders that they take risks for peace. It is an extraordinary reality in human history that societies and men are willing to take amazing risks in time of conflict, but often are unwilling to take even minimal risk in the cause of peace. In fact, as we know, most political leaders dislike risk-taking of any kind. Most get to be leaders by minimizing risk. So to ask them to be bold in dangerous circumstances is asking a lot, but it must be asked, and they must respond if there is to be any hope for peace. It can be done, and it did happen in Northern Ireland. Men and women, some of whom had never before met, never before spoken, who had spent their entire adult lives in conflict, some of whom had been shot, bombed, some of whom had served long prison terms for doing those things to others. They came together in agreement for peace. It can happen. It did happen. And it must happen in the Middle East. The fourth principle is to recognize that the implementation of agreements is even more difficult than getting the agreements. It's very hard to get opponents to agree on a course of action, but it's much harder to get them to do what they agreed upon later. That was the case in Northern Ireland. It took 10 years after the agreement before it was fully implemented. There's a final point on this subject that to me is so important. I have to mention it. It really goes beyond conflict. I recall very clearly my first day in Northern Ireland, although it was 15 years ago. I saw for the first time the huge wall which physically separates Catholics from Protestants in Belfast, the capital and largest city. 30 feet high, topped with barbed wire in places, it goes right through the middle of a city, in some cases right through buildings. It's an ugly reminder of the intensity and duration of the conflict. Ironically, it's called the Peace Line. On my first morning there, I met with Catholics on their side of the wall, in the afternoon with Protestants on their side of the wall. Their messages had not been coordinated, but they were essentially the same. In Belfast, they told me, and in other urban areas, there is a high correlation between unemployment and violence. They told me that where men and women have no opportunity, no hope, they are much more likely to take the path of violence. As I sat and listened to them, I thought I could just as easily be in Chicago or Calcutta or the Middle East. Despair is fuel for instability and conflict wherever it exists, and hope and opportunity are essential to peace and stability. Men and women everywhere need income to support their families, and they need the satisfaction of doing something meaningful in and with their lives. The conflict in Northern Ireland was obviously not exclusively or even primarily economic. It involved religion, national identity, competition for territory. The Good Friday Agreement succeeded because it acknowledged the legitimacy of the competing aspirations and encouraged both sides to advocate for it, but in democratic and peaceful ways. And it creates the possibility that economic prosperity, opportunity, and hope will flow from peace and contribute to peace. But the conflict exacted a terrible price, as all such conflicts do. And the price is almost always paid mostly by innocent people. In Northern Ireland, just 3 months after the agreement was reached and approved by the people in a referendum, a powerful bomb shattered the calm of a warm summer afternoon in a town called Omagh. Many dozens of people were killed. Hundreds and hundreds were grievously and horribly injured. And as we stood there amidst the death and destruction, it was laid bare the utter senselessness of trying to solve political problems there through violence. It didn't work, and in fact, it made things worse. 2 weeks later, Prime Minister Blair and President Clinton came to Omagh, and I accompanied them to meet with the survivors and the relatives of those who'd been killed. There were many hundreds of people present. It was an extremely emotional and moving day. Among the survivors were two with whom I spoke and who I'll never forget. A young woman named Claire Gallagher was 15 years old on the day of the blast. She lost both of her eyes. As we sat and talked, she, an aspiring concert pianist, had two large white patches where her eyes used to be. Michael Monaghan was 33 years old on that day. He lost his wife, who was pregnant, his 18-month-old daughter, and his wife's mother. Three generations wiped out in a single senseless moment. Despite their terrible and irreparable loss, both Claire and Michael went out of their way to tell me that they supported the peace process. They urged me to continue, and they asked me not to become discouraged. Their courage and determination are permanently etched in my memory. In fact, it was that memory that came back to me when President Obama asked me to serve as the U.S. Special Envoy for Peace in the Middle East. The President told me that he believes that comprehensive peace in the Middle East is not just good for Israelis and for Palestinians, but it is very much in the American national interest. Even before I was asked to serve, I knew it would be difficult. Last year, before President Obama was elected, when I had no idea that I would ever serve in my current position, I spoke at a university in Jerusalem. In the question and answer period, I was asked about Northern Ireland, and in reply, I described the process, and I pointed out that the peace agreement in Northern Ireland came 800 years after Britain began its domination of Ireland, 86 years after the partition of Ireland into North and South, 38 years after the British Army formally began its most recent mission in Ireland, 11 years after the peace talks began, and 9 years after a peace agreement was reached. Afterward, a group of people gathered around me, and an elderly gentleman came up and said he was hard of hearing, so he spoke very loudly. He said, "Did you say 800 years? I said, "Yes, 800 years. He repeated it even louder, "800 years. I said, "Yes, 800 years. He said, "Ah, such a recent argument. No wonder you got it settled." Well, in the Middle East, 800 years may be recent. But even there, I believe conflicts can be ended. There are, of course, many, many reasons to be skeptical about the prospect for success. The conflict has gone on for so long, has had such destructive effects, and has created such an atmosphere of mutual hostility and mistrust that many have come to regard it as inevitable and unchangeable. But President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton don't believe that. They believe, as I do, that the pursuit of peace is so important that it demands our maximum effort, no matter the difficulties, no matter the setbacks. The key is the mutual commitment of the parties and the active participation of the United States government, led by the President and the Secretary of State, with the support and assistance of the many governments and institutions outside of our country who want to help. Much is required of leaders who want to achieve the goal of two independent states living in peace. They must first reconcile the fact that the circumstances and objections of the two sides in the Middle East are different. Israel has a state, but its people live in anxiety and fear of suicide bombs and rocket attacks. Security for the people is their overriding objective. The Palestinians don't have a state, and they want one, an independent and economically viable state. That's their overriding objective. I believe that neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. Israel will not have sustainable security if the Palestinians don't have a state. And Palestinians will never achieve a state until the people of Israel have reasonable and sustainable security. This is all more likely to occur if a context can be created in which meaningful negotiations take place, and that's our objective. This is not a new American objective. It's been stated by many presidents. By President Bush in Jerusalem in 2008 when he said that, and I quote, "The point of departure for permanent status negotiations to realize this vision seems clear. There should be an end to the occupation that began in 1967. The agreement must establish Palestine as a homeland for the Palestinian people, just as Israel is a homeland for the Jewish people. These negotiations must ensure that Israel has secure, recognized, and defensible borders, and they must ensure that the state of Palestine is viable, contiguous, sovereign, and independent." It is vital that each side understands that satisfying the other's fundamental objectives is key to successful agreement. Security for Israel and viability of the Palestinian state are in the mutual interests of both parties. President Obama reaffirmed our policy this year, and he has broadened it to seek a comprehensive peace, which also includes Israel and Syria, Israel and Lebanon, and normal relations between Israel and all of the Arab nations in the region. Barack Obama is the only president in our time who has placed this issue high on the American agenda at the beginning of his presidency. Others did so at or near the end of their terms in office. Obama acted 48 hours after he was sworn in. And I can tell you from direct personal contact and observation, he is totally committed to comprehensive peace in the Middle East. Unfortunately, the culture of peace, which was so carefully nurtured during the Oslo process, appears to have largely dissipated, replaced by a sense of futility, despair, anger, frustration, a belief in the inevitability of conflict. As in Northern Ireland, there must be a determined, persevering effort to find a way to renew a sense of hope and possibility in the Middle East. I know that cynicism and fear, hostility and hatred are on the rise, and that it will be very difficult to overcome them. There is much history to overcome, but there also is a lot of history in Northern Ireland, and it was overcome. I don't for a moment underestimate the difficulty, and I've been reminded of it every day that I've spent in the Middle East in the past several months. It's volatile, it's complex, it's dangerous, and it's difficult. But the President and the Secretary of State have made it clear that danger and difficulty will not cause the United States to turn away. And we will not. We are going to stay the course until the job is done. Thank you all very much for having me here this evening. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. There are two microphones up front, one on each side. And while anyone who wants to ask a question is lining up, I do want to tell you a story about questions and answers. The last time I ran for the Senate, about a month before the election, I was in Portland, and I was invited to come to a high school in rural northern Maine. And I went. It was about a three-hour drive. And I had spoken at enough high schools in Maine to realize that the attention span of students to my remarks had not yet reached 1 minute. So I developed a practice of not speaking. I simply got up and took questions. And on that day, the students were all assembled in the bleachers, and the principal and I went out, and there were two chairs and a microphone in the middle of the gym. And he got up and introduced me, and I got up, and I invited questions or comments or speeches by the students. A young man got up out of the bleachers, and he walked across the gym toward me. He had a big pile of papers under his arm. I knew trouble was coming. He got up and he put the papers down on the podium and he began to read what turned out to be a one-hour speech. So I stood there next to him for a while, awkwardly, and then I realized I could see he's one of these guys who ran his finger under each line that I was in for quite a while. So I went and sat down next to the principal. He was very angry. He leaned over, he said, "Senator, we called this assembly so the students could hear you." He said, "We can hear that kid every day." And in fact, we do. He said, "You are the majority leader of the United States Senate. You are a person of responsibility and authority. Go up there and take the microphone away from that kid." I looked at the kid. I'd never seen him before, but I thought, this kid may well have a lot of relatives of voting age. So I said to the principal, I said, "In this building, you are a person of authority." I said, "Why do you think you're paid such a big salary?" That really got him mad. I said, "You go up and take the microphone." We didn't move. The kid spoke for the whole hour. This is a true story. The bell rang, and all the students poured out of the gym. And I left for the three-hour drive back to Portland, resolving never again to invite speeches in a question-and-answer period. Did you get my message? Did you get my message?
No.
Go ahead.
What are your immediate goals for the Middle East conflict? Right. Like, in the next year, what do you hope you can accomplish?
We believe that the only realistic solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a two-state solution in which the two states are living side by side in peace and security. We also believe that in order to achieve that objective, there has to be a process by which they discuss the issues that divide them, which are many. The divisions are deep. We also believe that that will require active participation by the United States in the process. And so our immediate objective is to encourage discussions directly between the parties with our involvement to address what are referred to in the jargon of the area as the permanent status or final status issues that they have to resolve. Borders, refugees, security, settlements, Jerusalem, and others. We are both aided and hindered by the fact that there is a long history of such discussion. Much has been said and written, much has been negotiated. This is not writing on a blank sheet. And there is much reference to history which adds to the divisions, multiplies misunderstanding and disagreement. But that history also points the way toward what an acceptable ultimate solution may be. And so the immediate objective is to begin meaningful negotiation with a time limit that will produce a just agreement that will meet the principal objectives of both sides. And we believe it can be done, and we believe that notwithstanding the tremendous difficulty that has occurred, there remain majorities in both societies who share that view.
I'll reduce my tome to one sentence and then one quick question. And that's just to say that there are tens of thousands of American Jews working towards a negotiated two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then my question, I got an email from a colleague who's in Israel now, a Jewish colleague, who wondered if President Obama could speak to Israelis in Israel in the same form that he spoke to the Arab world in Cairo.
Yes, I believe he can and that he will. At an appropriate time and in an appropriate circumstance. He believes, and I share the view, that it is important that he do so. We have to acknowledge the reality that in both societies there are different points of view. There are different policies. There are different parties, not unlike our own country, in which we have very sharp differences of opinion on very important issues. And in every society, no matter the form of government, political leaders are constrained by the views of the members of that society. That's what we call democracy. And so public opinion among Israelis and Palestinians and others in the region is important because it does have a constraining or an encouraging effect on leaders. And so I repeat what I said at the outset. Yes, I believe it can happen, should happen, and will happen. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Thanks for coming. It's always wonderful to hear what you have to say. I have a question about the fact that the World Bank has somewhat come to the conclusion that involving women in improving the economic status of a country is important because they repay their loans and their families' incomes increase and their education level increases. And their
yes.
Do you see a possible role for involving women in the same way in peace negotiations?
Yes. In fact, in Northern Ireland, that was a critical factor in moving the process toward a resolution. The entry of women into the process and their active participation in a to a degree that had not previously existed. And I believe that's true in every society for a variety of reasons. I mentioned in my remarks the rapid growth of population in the world. Although demography, there are different points of view about demography, and there are different projections. There are some studies which suggest that the single most important factor in reducing very high rates of population growth is the education and empowerment of women. That some studies suggest that it has very dramatic and immediate effects when it occurs. It's an open question as to whether that is true across all cultures and all regions of the world, but there is experience to demonstrate that. And so independent of the value of doing something that is right on its own merits is the benefit that can accrue to a society, both in terms of ending conflict, bringing about a peaceful resolution, but most importantly, in creating the economic growth and job creation that is so essential to stability in any society. And we have to be clear about this. This is universal. This applies in the United States just as well as it does elsewhere. We have problems in that regard. We all see now the difficulties that ensue from high employment and the despair that occurs in those who are affected by it. And so I think it is a critically important element in the full development of every society, both in terms of permitting each individual to achieve, to go as high and as far as talentness and willingness to work and willingness to risk will take them, men and women, and in the contribution that a fully empowered society makes to advancement. And so my answer is a definite yes.
Thank you for your talk this evening, Senator Mitchell. My question... Over the years, various administrations have had various ways of describing Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Carter's administration called settlements illegal. Then there was a time in which these settlements were called obstacles to peace. And in 2004, Bush characterized or stated that Palestinians and Israelis have to accept the realities on the ground, specifically mentioning Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem, the three main settlement blocks. My question is to you, at a time when the U.S. plays has such a large influence in the Middle East, or the ability to be a huge broker in this peace settlement between the Israeli and Palestinians, what U.S. policy is on these settlements? And if U.S. policy is that they are illegal, what are their plans to do about the continuing growth of these Israeli settlements, and if they consider them illegal, why the U.S. does when UN and international law say that these Israeli settlements are, in fact, illegal.
President Obama has stated repeatedly the United States policy in that regard, most recently in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly, in which he stated the United States does not accept the legitimacy of Israeli settlements. That is the policy stated by the President repeatedly, and it continues to be the policy to this time. Of course, the Israeli government does not agree with our policy in that regard, and that has been the case for every American administration since settlements began to be an issue approximately 40 years ago.
Senator, in regards to the exponential population growth that you mentioned earlier, do you see any, can you predict any conflict resolution that may arise? In regards to the, disputes over water, over land rights, do you see any way to solve these conflicts in the future?
Well, the most effective way, of course, to solve conflicts is to prevent them from beginning, and that's why I think it is critically important that we recognize, as we now appear to have done so as a society, that what happens in different parts of the world has an effect on us, on our lives, and on our futures, and that we should be pursuing policies which reduce the likelihood of conflict by helping to create hope and opportunity and a rising standard of living throughout the world. Now, this does not mean, and I want to emphasize this, that every conflict and every problem arises because of economic problems. It is very clear that there are many people in this world who are irredeemably hostile to us, irrespective of economic circumstance or otherwise. And there are many evil people in the world who commit acts of horrific atrocity that are unrelated to economic circumstance or background. So it is not an absolute either-or, but at the same time, it's very clear that growth, job creation, opportunity, and hope certainly shrinks the pool of those who might otherwise turn to violence and makes it more difficult for those who are unmoved by rational argument or even self-interest to act in this way. So one of the reasons I believe that President Obama is so widely admired around the world is that people in just about every continent and in most of the countries of the world regard him as pursuing a policy of enlightened self-interest in that regard. That is to say, recognizing that our interests are best served when other countries move toward democratic institutions and act in a manner which provides rights and opportunities and hope for their people, and that we benefit from that just as well as they do. And that while we cannot, must not, and would never foreclose the possibility of the use of force to protect and defend our interests, after all, this was a nation that was born in a violent revolution, we have to put that in perspective and as one of many tools at our disposal in trying to deal with problems in the world and preventing conflicts from arising.
You were just talking about the role in democracy in sort of alleviating conflict around the world. And I was wondering, when Hamas won the elections in 2006 for the PLC, they were shunned by the international community, and to some extent that's played a big role in radicalizing them and causing the war in Gaza in 2008. And I was wondering, in the Obama administration, is there any chance that you would try to bring back Hamas into the peace process by allowing them their role in a democracy? Hopefully that would moderate them.
Yes. Let's be clear about elections and democracy. One of the disagreements that I personally had with the previous administration was the view, implicit in many statements and even explicit in some, that if you have an election, you're a democracy. That you, it's sort of like it's a door that you walk through, and once you're through the door, you're a democracy. Well, I believe that, to the contrary, open and free and fair elections are essential to a democracy, but by themselves do not make a democracy. Let's remember, Hitler was elected in a free and open democratic election. And his was not the first case and won't be the last of people and parties who are elected through the democratic process and immediately upon taking office make sure that no one else is ever elected in a democratic process. Democracy is an ongoing demand. You don't say, I won an election and therefore I have no further responsibilities. Let's use a simple and obvious and clearly hypothetical example. What would we say if an American political party, after winning an election, organized an armed militia, the Democratic Party militia, to make certain that if there was any disagreement with any of its decisions in the future, the militia would be able to suppress the opposition and enforce them? Well, could anybody say, well, we're a democracy because we had an election? That's the problem with the proposition that you presented. An election is an essential ingredient to the establishment of democracy, but by itself, it does not confer permanent democracy on a society. It is an ongoing burden, which not a burden, we regard it as a blessing, of course, but is an ongoing demand that must be met. And that has not occurred in the case of which you described. Now, what we have said is that we welcome the participation in the process of all of the factions, provided they meet a fundamental test, and that is a commitment to democratic principles. And so far, that has not been forthcoming. And one of those commitments to democratic principles is to accept the obligations that were previously made, and others. And so my view is we want everybody in. We want a big tent. I'm constantly asked in the Middle East, well, Senator, you did it in Northern Ireland. There were violent factions there. And the answer is, in Northern Ireland, I established a set of principles. They came to be named after me, the Mitchell Principles, to which every political party that wanted to enter the negotiations had to subscribe publicly and privately. And they required a commitment to nonviolence, an acceptance of decisions made by the majority in the process, and a commitment not to try to change the outcome through the use of violence. It explicitly authorized and encouraged political parties to advocate for their point of view through peaceful and democratic means in elections. But what it said was you can't have a private army that you're going to use the first time someone does something you don't like. It's incompatible with democracy.
Thanks for your generosity and your time in coming here. And I have a two-part question. One is that, to my understanding, in conflict resolution, the person who's doing the mediation needs to be seen as an impartial person. And so the question that I have is, if that is true, and you can disabuse me of that notion if it's not, the United States has a much closer relationship with Israel than it does with the Palestinian nation. Right. It puts a lot of money into Israel. I believe there's a lot of ways in which it's not a symmetrical relationship. Right. So I'm wondering how you work with the perception of where the United States is in relation to the two parties.
Right. The United States was the first country to recognize Israel's existence. 10 minutes after David Ben-Gurion announced the creation of the State of Israel, President Harry Truman announced American recognition. We have had a strong and close relationship since then, and we are unalterably committed to Israel's security and its ability to survive with defensible borders in a secure situation. At the same time, we favor the creation of a Palestinian state, a state which is independent, viable, in which the people have the right to determine their own future. We do not believe, as I stated in my remarks, that these are incompatible, but rather we think just the opposite, that neither can attain its objective unless and until the other attains its objective. What you say is true. There is a widespread perception, not just among Arabs, not just among Muslims, but around the world, that the United States is biased in favor of Israel. There is also a realistic recognition by all concerned, including Arabs and Muslims, that this problem cannot be solved without active American participation in mediation. It is no accident that every time something difficult occurs in the region, the leaders of all of the governments, the Arab governments, hold press conferences, demand more American involvement, not less, even though their publics are generally hostile to the United States. Because the fact of the matter is, there is not an entity on earth that has the capacity to create the context within which agreement can be reached and of crucial significance can ensure its acceptance and durability. And so if you're writing a theoretical textbook about mediation, it would always be better to bring in someone who has no prior history or record. But if you're writing a history of the world as it is in the 21st century, the reality is that there is not going to be a durable resolution to this conflict without the active and direct involvement of the United States government, both to create the context, to bring the parties together, to encourage agreement, and, again, crucially, to ensure its acceptance on a permanent basis. And everybody in the region recognizes that. I've met with the leaders of 15 Arab countries, and not one of them has said to me, "We want the United States to go home." Every single one has said, "We want you here more. You should be doing now." To be sure, they tell us we wish you'd be less supportive of Israel. We wish you'd be more supportive of us. But nobody says, "Go home." Everybody says, "Come here." And without exception, those governments welcomed President Obama's emphasis on solving this problem early in his government, early in his tenure in office. And they have high expectations. I think one of the concerns that those of us who support the president have is that expectations of what he might do there, never mind there, here, and everywhere, are very high and going to be very difficult to meet. But in the specific instance to which you refer, that's the reality of the situation. I'll take one more. Okay, good. Sorry, guys.
Thank you for being here with us tonight, Senator Mitchell. My question for you, I think I speak for a lot of people in this room when I say a lot of us have seen this before. A president take a stance that we're going to find peace between Israel and Palestine. And then it always falls through. What is different? What is different this time? And I guess on a personal level, what made you sign on?
Right.
What has changed?
I'll answer in two parts. What has changed is that for the first time in my adult lifetime, we have a president who placed this high on the agenda right at the beginning of his term, not at the end. That's a huge factor. The second is not wanting to disagree with you, but questioning the premise of your comment. And I don't want to preach it to students, but I think there's a life lesson here. If you take the position that you tried something that you believed in, and it didn't work once, twice, or three times, that you're going to give up, you're going to find a lot, that you will go through life without solving a lot of problems that you could have solved. In Northern Ireland, I had 700 days of failure and one day of success. I was asked not dozens, but hundreds of times by reporters, "Senator, you failed. When are you going home?" Politicians held press conferences demanding that I go home on a regular basis. I persevered because although I was often discouraged, I always believed that it could be done. And the same question was asked. There had been peace negotiations in 1974. There had been peace negotiations in 1979. There had been peace negotiations as recently as 2 years before I started. And they had all failed. What makes you think this is different? Well, you keep at it. You don't get discouraged. You don't succumb to despair. And you try to create an atmosphere of hope and determination, and it won't always work. I've had plenty of things that I've tried in life that I failed at. Sandy always likes to point out my losing race for governor. I sort of airbrushed it from my mind, but he never fails to bring it up when I come here. So what I think is different, probably to sum up an overly long answer, I think Obama does make a difference. I think it's widely recognized around the world. And I took it for the reasons I stated at the outset. I feel I've been very lucky. My mother was an immigrant. She couldn't read or write English. My father was the orphan son of immigrants. He left school after the fourth grade. Because of the openness of American society, because of all the helping hands I got in my life, I became the majority leader of the United States Senate. I think if I've gotten all these benefits, I've got a responsibility to help when I'm asked to help. And when the President of the United States asks you to do something that might be helpful, that might save a life. And I really did think about Claire Gallagher's eyes and Michael's children. You can make a difference. And if you can, you got to try and try and try and not be discouraged, not be deterred, and most of all, don't be put off by the instant experts out there who will proclaim failure the first time you swing and miss at a curveball. You just got to keep at it, and sometime, sooner or later, you will connect. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Senator, thank you so much. As my friends at Colby know, we never let somebody leave without a gift from the Gold Farm Center. I think at Seal Harbor, this will keep you warm at appropriate times. And I've checked with the State Department Ethics Office. It's not worth too much, so you can take it. I get to stand up here, but I really want to thank Susanna Thompson and Ashley Oliver. Susanna's the assistant director of the Gold Farm Center, and Ashley Oliver is the... They really make these events flow as seamlessly as they do, and particularly to the Mitchell family and to Senator Mitchell. This is a wonderful tradition at Colby, and we cannot wait till next year to have you back. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's speaker was former U.S. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, now Presidential Envoy to the Middle East. He spoke at Colby College last week. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with George Mitchell, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again anytime by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. For Speaking in Maine, I'm John Keimel.